Welcome to CYC Podcast, Discussions on Child and Youth Care. I'm your host, Wolfgang Vashon. I started my career in theater, that was socially engaged and worked within communities. I was also drawn towards drama therapy. I was attracted to the powerful impact of theater and was frequently amazed at what drama accessed, which other ways of working did not. I've continued to keep theater integral in my work with young people and my teaching. One of the very first people who taught me about the power and potential of therapeutic theater was Dr. Stephen Snow, and he is my guest today. Dr. Snow has developed a specialty in therapeutic theater. In the past 20 years, he's directed over 25 theater productions with diverse casts, including persons with mental health challenges, developmental disabilities, young people, and the blind. He has published articles and lectured on various aspects of drama therapy, both nationally and internationally, and he's been the principal investigator in several ethnodrama research projects. He is also the chair of the Department of Creative Arts Therapies at Concordia University.
Actually, he was
the chair.
No longer.
Well, congratulations on no longer being the chair. Welcome, Stephen, and thank you for joining me today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Wolfgang. It's really nice to connect with you again. And, you know, I always saw that passion you had for theater as an engaged way of working with the community. And, you know, that's another really, I think, a really important way to use the powerful resource of theater.
Yes, absolutely. It's really followed me throughout my career in so many ways. You know, I obviously have been very passionate about theater, and I also recognize that there's many ways to engage with theater. Theater's worked for me, but from your perspective, why use creative expressive arts to work with young people as opposed to other modalities or other approaches?
Well, it's you know, the big thing with the expressive approaches or the expressive arts therapies approaches or the creative arts therapies approaches, they get you moving in the body with rhythm. And really, you know, there's kind of a synesthetic approach that opens up all the avenues of communication, and especially, you know, nonverbally. So sometimes young people don't like to, you know, express themselves verbally, but then you have movement, you've got music, and all those kinds of things. So I think it opens up to personal self-expression and communication.
In a way that other ways of working just don't access.
Yes.
So there's a big push right now, as you're very aware, around evidence and rapidness, right? So all the funding seems to go into looking at how effective CBT is and how much quicker we can therapize people, as an example. What's the evidence base for creative expressive arts?
Well, you know, my field is drama therapy, so I can only really, and I've been engaged in that for like 30 years, so I can really only speak from that point of view with some offensive, realistic orientation to it. I'm very proud to say in our field we finally have an international journal called the Drama Therapy Review, DTR, and publications are going into that really are evidence-based. Now, I'm very much a qualitative researcher with a background, pretty strong background in social science, but I have a great partner I worked with for 20 years who's a quantitative researcher. And we just published a couple articles in the Drama Therapy Review. The first one was actually quite a statistical quantitative evidence-based study, which we're very happy about, that demonstrated the value of drama therapy in improving the social skills of elementary school children on the autism spectrum, with autism spectrum disorder.
How was theater used or drama therapy used with people on the spectrum?
Okay, I can tell you that I was actually the advisor for we had on that project. It was a research project at the Center for the Arts and Human Development, and we had a student, and we had a professional drama therapist. And they created, to me, I was astounded with some of the brilliance of their work, honestly. What they created was a world, a fantasy world, for 10 to 11-year-old boys. And the main character in it was a space creature that came down to Earth and was sort of befuddled by being on this planet. But there was such immediate engagement with these kids who already have a little bit of an alienated position in society. I wish I could remember what the name of this creature was. And this creature would help him write letters home to his parents on this other planet. It was what we call a projective method, but an incredible vehicle to catalyze the self-expression of these kids. And that was the drama. It had role-playing, it had just movement, all scripting, you know. And the very end of it, the two drama therapists created a little Nassau Center, and they sent the creature back to his home on this other planet. And that was the closure for the whatever it was. I think it was a 3-month group.
Wow. That sounds so amazing. And then so different than, you know, what we're used to around people with ASD or living on the spectrum. You know, we focus on, you know, applied behavior analysis and this sort of rigorous follow me versus, you know, let's follow you, let's follow your imagination.
Exactly. They really got so engaged in this world, and the student drama therapist and the professional drama therapist did such a good job of it and urging them to really publish their whole process. And they both actually work in this field. I know the student got a very good job in New York State, working with autism. And the good, really great thing about it, we got excellent statistical evidence that there was real improvements in various social functioning aspects of the young elementary school boys in the study.
So through this process, you were able to show that there was a statistically relevant improvement in specific social skills using drama therapy.
Absolutely. If you want, you can get this online. The Drama Therapy Review. It was the first volume of it. I don't remember if you remember Nisha Sajnani. Did you know Nisha at all?
I don't think so. No.
Yeah, well, Nisha's become quite a force in the field of drama therapy. She's the director of the drama therapy program at Lesley University in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And she was really very instrumental in getting this journal founded, which the purpose of it was, be able to articulate research going on in the field. So, like I say, I can really only speak for the field of drama therapy or maybe a little bit for the field of creative arts therapies, but there's definitely, just like you were suggesting, a pressure to create evidence-based research and also a push from the field itself.
Maybe we could take a step back then and let me ask you, how would you define drama therapy?
Well, drama therapy is really... quite simple to define on a basic level. It's the use of dramatic media, all kinds, role-playing, storytelling, performance, masks, and puppets for the purpose of psychotherapy. So it's the integration of the principles of psychotherapy from whatever school you happen to come from with the actual practice of drama.
And are there particular groups that it works better for or worse for? You talked about people who live on the autism spectrum. Are there other groups that it's particularly effective?
Well, from my point of view, it really can be almost applied to any human condition and any human the personality. Now, that's a really grandiose statement, but I always tell my students there's a great doctoral dissertation on going into Piaget and the other developmental psychologists. And when you go down, especially look in Piaget, and you see fundamentally we become human beings by dramatic means, imitation, role-playing. And so these skills are innate within us. Mm. And, you know, Piaget himself saw how powerful play was as a kind of a spontaneous mode of drama therapy for kids, and has written and wrote about that. So just in the nature of becoming, you know, human in our developmental process, and, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years old, we're embracing the dramatic media in ways of expressing, but most of us lose that because we lose our sense of play, and that, and in some ways, what the drama therapy is, re-engaging people in the power of spontaneous play.
Mm-hmm. You know, I've worked a lot with adolescents, and I've been saying increasingly that the more I work in this field, the more I want to work with younger and younger children. And I think part of it is my attraction to that play. You know, I've had some experience working with young 5, 4, 5, 6 year olds recently, and wow, it's endless. I mean, you talk about improvisation masters. It's unbelievable, right? Spending time in that world. It's nonstop.
The field of drama therapy has developed enough now. It's, I don't know if you want to say 50 years. We actually have different schools. And one of the big techniques in drama therapy, and I don't know if you've come across this because I think you would love it, it's called the developmental transformations. It's a technique created by a colleague of mine who's a professor of psychology at Yale University, but he's also a drama therapist for 30, 40 years. And it's very theoretically sound. I mean, it's based like on self-psychology, object relations, but in essence what it is, it's embodied free association. Hmm. And I've done it quite a bit. I'm not trained in it, but I've done a lot of it to find out about it. It's scary as hell, because when you're improvising, you come up against your blocks. What are the big blocks in your life? Are they money? Are they sex? Are they power? It comes right there, smack in your face when you're improvising. And, you know, you can look it up, developmental transformations. Mm-hmm. If you Google it, you'll see it's quite an established method. And he is having tremendous success in the inner city schools with this method, where they actually they take kids out of class and they have them practice it, and they've got studies that now show it really relaxes them and helps them to concentrate when they go back into their class. And these are kids usually that are not doing very well in school because of behavior problems and problems at home and different things. So that's just one example of one discipline or what do I want to call it? A method, really. It's mm-hmm. a method in the field of drama therapy.
One of the other methods that you sent me some articles that you've published on this, and I'm very intrigued with it, is the idea of ethnodrama. Mm-hmm. Would you call ethnodrama drama therapy?
No. Ethnodrama is not drama therapy per se, but I'll go probably to the last point that we can go back and start backwards with it. I have developed my own method that actually is called ethnodrama therapy. Mm. And it takes in to consider the ethno, which means a group from the Greek. It's drama in terms of dramatic action and media use, and it's a therapeutic process. So it's complex because it's meant to cover three things: research, dramatic arts, and therapy. But that's where I've gotten to after 20 years or so. Ethnodrama itself was created by Jim Jankowski in Australia in the 1990s, I think around 95. And it's a health education method based on a postmodern critical ethnographic technique in which you take a group of people. The first group he actually worked with were people, high-functioning people with schizophrenia. And the question was, what is it to have a psychotic experience? Well, who can tell you better than someone that's had it? So he would use interviews and focus groups and collect narratives from them. And then those were translated into drama and enacted by, in that case, it happened to be student actors and student nurses. And then they would take that to the mental health community, psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, creative arts therapists, whoever, and they would create a discussion about the system. You know what? You should probably read. You would like Neil Chikowski. It's very political. The biggest thing to read, if you really want to read the foundation of it, is his doctoral dissertation. It's a really good model for a doctoral dissertation, too, in which he kind of goes into how you change systems. And he's a lot of political thought in that. And it would have been looked at as kind of a radical ethnography, because it was completely based on giving the power to the informant.
Hmm. What makes it different than theater? So
it is theater. It's what they call now research-based theater.
Okay. Okay.
Which can sound deadly, but if it's done well, it actually there's a beautiful statement that he makes. Because both me and Chikowski and I were very influenced by Victor Turner. I actually studied with Turner. Mm-hmm. Maybe I can, because that will help give my sort of journey with it. But he talks about what Turner was trying to do in a thing called performing ethnography, a method that I trained with him in, was to bring together the aesthetic aspects of theater with the principles of research. And this is actually quite pre-ethnodrama. Ethnodrama would be thought to be in the framework of performance ethnography. Performance ethnography. If you want to know about that, read Norman Denzin. But what Victor Turner was doing when I studied with him at NYU in the 1980s was called performing ethnography. So he would take a quacutal ritual, and instead of his students reading about it, they would enact it. They would embody it. So he was always talking about, he was a wonderful professor, he would talk about putting experiential flesh on cognitive bones. Well, that's kind of what theater does, and in a certain way that's a big principle for ethnodrama. Because Mia Chikowski then took anthropology and said, okay, or ethnography, which is a very simple thing, ethno, a group of people, graph, a picture, it's a portrait of a people. And the old-fashioned way of doing it was, all the famous ethnographies, to write about it, to create a book, to create a monograph, later on to make a film. So he took it into this realm of, let's take it and embody it as a play. So the transcripts of interviews are then used as the dialogue and the narration in the play.
So let's get concrete here for a moment. You did quite a fascinating, the write-up of it was so intriguing to me, a program with young women who had been incarcerated or were incarcerated at the time of doing this ethnography, ethnodrama. Can you tell me a bit about that ethnodrama that you were part of?
Sure, I would be happy to. Incarcerated might be a little bit too strong. Maybe I have used that word. They're actually in youth protection.
Okay.
Meaning that they've done something where a judge says they have to be in youth protection, either harm to themselves or harm to somebody else. One of the young women I'd worked with had tried to commit suicide. Other ones had run away from home. Some of them have gotten into prostitution. I mean, all kinds of things. So they're in a facility, but it's not necessarily, it's not under lock and key, but they're under very strict rules. They have to, attend school. They have jobs they have to do, et cetera, et cetera. Honestly, this was one of the most challenging projects that I ever tried, I ever took on. And I had some money for it. I had an internal grant from Concordia. And the idea of it was to find out, a lot of my work in ethnodrama has actually been about stigma. And we felt that these girls were highly stigmatized because they had a stigma of being in this facility. So they were 14 to 18 years old, I think, was the oldest. And we were also trying to measure if there was any change in their self-perception going through this process. But that got put aside a little bit. What we did, we did a pre-interview with an audience, and then we did a post-interview with an audience. And we did find, which is one of the powers of Ethnogram, a lot of empathy, for their perspective and how they saw things. And everybody said how moved they were by their honesty. And they were very, very open. Well, they were very honest in this. Yeah.
Yeah, when I was reading excerpts of the script, they name the facility that they're in. They, they're performing that at the facility. They're swearing about the facility. And I was, right. And some of the audience members were staff and people at that facility. And I was really struck by the candor of these young women and the ability and the willingness of all participants to name it and to listen. How do you create that space?
There were a couple of things, really. Now, I want to tell the truth here. they were pretty tough on this old white guy. And what was really funny for me was the personality they had in the group process and the personality they had when I interviewed them individually was like totally different. Mm-hmm. Once they were, in their collective, they were like, tough just fuck all authority. And, but when I would talk to them alone, and I did interviews with every single one of them, in-depth interviews, so I would know their story, understand their story. They were so sensitive and sweet and just very, very honest in what they were talking about. Some of them had pretty tough lives. One of the biggest word I think in ethnodrama, and it's always to me, it's such an important word because it combines with theater and it combines with therapy, is authenticity. You're looking for this mirror of authenticity that helps people to really understand what it's like to be whoever the group is. I mean, ethnodramas thousands of them have been done now. With every, one of the ones that I always found so interesting, there was an ethnodrama of what it is to be a gay gym teacher in high schools in North America. Yeah. There's been them done on what is it to have brain damage. I mean, just so many different areas. But it's the ring and the power of the theater as a mirror of truth. And when you have that authenticity and it's enacted with authenticity, it's a very powerful form of theater.
Indeed. I would certainly imagine so. I mean, I've not seen an ethnodrama. I've certainly seen, research-based theater, and I've seen, what sometimes called
journalism. Right. Well, I'm surprised in a way because it's so over, and I would think it would be so, in your milieu. Mm-hmm. You mentioned to me at one point a while ago, Anne DeVere Smith.
Yes.
Well, Anne DeVere Smith would be sort of a star. She's brilliant.
Yeah, absolutely.
And she's kind of doing, ethnodrama.
Right.
She's collecting interviews, and then she talks a lot about the power of language and trying to capture that ring of authentic language. And so if you want to look at theater and look at this stuff academically or intellectually or theoretically, read Norman Denzin, D-E-N-Z-I-N, because he's really able to discuss it on that level. But Anne DeVere Smith, who's also very much a theoretician, but really comes into it as a theater artist. So she's very inspiring.
Mm-hmm. I don't know that she talks about her work. For those listeners who don't know Anne DeVere Smith, made some very, very famous plays, did one about the L.A. riots, and, and interviewed a variety of people and then portrayed all those different characters on stage in a one-person show, which phenomenally successful and quite brilliant, that show. I don't know that she would call herself necessarily a researcher as such. And there seems to be something about the, you know, the assessment.
I would actually be surprised if she wouldn't, because
Okay.
She's now a professor in my old department at NYU. And she was a fellow at Harvard, so you know, she still acts on TV and movies and stuff, but she's very intellectually engaged with kind of the whole performance studies movement.
Nice. You've done some other ethnodramas that have been quite fascinating to me. One of them I'd like to talk about for a moment is caregivers, because a lot of the listeners, of course, are caregivers or are studying to become caregivers in a formal sense. What was that research project, and what was the result? What data did you find from that ethnodrama?
Well, this is one we're still working on, and I'm actually applying for a grant to continue with it. It's about looking at mental illness from the perspective of the caregiver. So I have many interviews done with parents who have children with schizophrenia or bipolar, or who tried to commit suicide, or a brother or a sister or a parent. So it's really, really about mental illness in the family. And that was very personal for myself, because my father was bipolar and had a couple of major psychotic episodes in his life. So I came into it with a point of view of wanting to learn more of what the perspective of caregivers are. And I think we did about 20 interviews. And we also did a 6-hour workshop last June that was filmed, and that was tremendously helpful, because I think you'll be interested in this, Wolfgang. We actually used playback theater as the vehicle of exploring the narratives, and that's been part of my work in ethnodrama since 2005, really using playback as a method of exploring people's stories.
And have you found anything in particular based upon the research thus far that you were able to share?
Well, we're still okay. There's often really two or three components to the research in ethnodrama. First of all, is gathering the data. That is going out, doing interviews, doing focus groups, reading backgrounds, reading books, getting all this information. And then the second is to produce it as a play, and hopefully as a viable play with aesthetic components. Now, the third, which I think is more what you're asking about, is the actual analysis and evaluation of both the play that's produced, but even more significant, the audience's response. So, you know, I felt like with the ethnodrama on the young women, we were able to, you know, get a lot of empathy, greater understanding, decrease the stigmatization. This project, the third part, is still coming. We're actually very much in the second part, which is performing the play and then discussing with audiences.
Right. It's really fascinating work that you're doing, Stephen. I'm so intrigued with it. I'm struck as well by the breadth of groups that you're working with, you know, from incarcerated young women, you know, for whatever reason, you know, youth protection, to caregivers, people with mental health issues, mental disabilities, mental illnesses. You've done stuff around people with developmental delays and sexuality, you know, the autism, you know, that was more drama therapy, but it's, you know, quite fascinating how broad it is. And as we come to a close, is there anything else that you think is salient to our conversation today to wrap up what we've been talking about?
Well, for people who don't know about it, to really, you know, read the Saldana books or go back to, I highly recommend, Nian Chikowski wrote a lot of articles and his dissertation. And, you know, if you Google it, you're going to see it all the different ways it's practiced, and there's a lot of excitement about it being a research-based, you know, form of theater. And a lot of it's become more sophisticated now. There's a lot of questions, too. I feel fortunate because it brought my two trainings together. I mean, I have doctoral training in performance studies, performance ethnography, and then postgraduate training further in drama therapy. So it's been great for me because it's brought together those two worlds. And, you know, I'm kind of at the end of my career, so it's pretty much ethnodrama the rest of the way for me. I'm hoping to do two more. I'm hoping to take the caregiver ethnodrama out as a form of public mental health education to the general public, and then actually have some very sophisticated measures around its effectiveness as education. I've got some great people working with me on that. I'm going to do another one after that, and I'm not quite sure. I was thinking of doing it on the family relationships when someone in the family has a developmental disability. I'm not quite sure about that one. But the third one I'm very inspired to do, I would like to do with the transgender community. Because Epigon is a vehicle, a powerful vehicle, to work with marginalized and oppressed groups. And I've been studying, because the play I saw last summer, the incredible stigmatization and really violence towards people who are transgender. So I'd like to do that in about 2 years.
I don't think you're retiring anytime soon, Stephen. I hate to break it to you. it doesn't sound like it's imminent. Thank you so much.
I'm actually very much hoping to write a book about ethnodrama therapy because it's, you know, it is a method that I've actually synthesized myself, and it actually does work, and it's kind of like it takes in, it seemingly can integrate research, theater arts, and therapy. So that's something I'm working on.
Well, when you publish the book, send it to me, and we will have another conversation about it. Because I would, I'm gonna read many of your resources.
See you before then.
Yes, I hope so too. Thank you so much. Thank you for taking the time to talk with me today and explaining about drama therapy and particularly ethnodrama. Fascinating work. And what I'll do is I'll link to the journal, the drama therapy journal, from the podcast website, and some of the names as well.
Please, because both the article on autism, but also the article on working with the young women, it had been published in that journal in volume 1 and 2.
And it's open access, that journal.
I think at this point you actually have to pay.
Okay.
I think it was for a short time, but now it's more, it's quite a sophisticated academic journal. So I think you actually have to pay to get into it.
Okay. I'll post it and maybe people can talk to their friends at school. Thank you very, very much. And, I hope you have a wonderful day and good luck with the grant writing, Stephen.
Thanks a lot, Wolfgang.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
This concludes this month's episode of CYC Podcast.
Tune in next time for more discussions on child and youth care. Subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher.
Visit us online at cycpodcast.org.